Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
By Desai, and Desai is still going for Milan. 4-0 now to the Rossoneri, and surely they have wrapped this up. The suspended Franco Baresi waits patiently on the touchline, but this was won a long time ago. AC Milan under Fabio Capello have won the UEFA Champions League.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and today we have a slightly different episode whereby we are talking about an individual club. Now, before we go into a little bit more detail, because there is a little bit of a reason behind it, but the reason will become more clear as we go through the podcast. However, first of all, as per usual, I would like to take this moment to introduce my most two favourite podcast hosts in the world. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Very well, thanks, Stuart. Very well. How's things going your end?
Okay, not too bad, thank you. Now we've got the recording equipment working and the Skype's working. Yeah. Now we've got the usual technical difficulties that we normally have. We're all set and we're good to go. How are you?
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, it's been a quiet weekend because it's international weekend. So yeah, no updates on Liverpool's quest. So it's been quite a relaxed feet up kind of weekend for me.
Excellent, excellent. Looking forward to this particular show.
Oh yeah, how could you not do? You know what a club they are. You know, and I mean, I don't have necessarily, you know, most people that you speak to. I mean, I did a poll on Twitter yesterday that's still rumbling on about, you know, what team would you class as being your Italian side, your Serie A or whatever side, you know, division they're in. And it provoked a really interesting conversation. But, this side leads the poll at the minute with a couple of days to go.
Brilliant. Excellent. I like that. Very, very contemporary research based on what we're doing.
I thought so.
I like what you've done there. So. And people say we don't understand technology.
Exactly. Exactly.
Obviously, talking about not understanding technology, Gary, you're up next. How are you,
buddy? Bob, fine. Thank you, matey. And I'm sitting here wearing a shirt of the club we're going to talk about today. They're one of my favourite clubs that don't wear blue and come from West London. they were sort of a majestic club in the areas we're going to talk about. I won't give the story away, but one of the prime aristocratic clubs of Europe.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And by chance, by luck, or by good management, however you want to call it, we also have a special guest with us, as we always do, who are actually usually more of an expert than the three of us combined. And obviously this show is no different. But before we introduce our guest, I'd just like to say, obviously, guys, the reason why we're doing this, for the listeners who aren't aware, and obviously hopefully the listeners that we have all the time are aware, we produce bi-monthly magazines, and at the moment we are in the middle of a run of club editions. The magazines are usually 13, 14 long-form articles written by These Football Times writers, and it's obviously available on the These Football Times website, which is www.thesefootballtimes.co. The magazine, print magazine, is £10. They always look sensational. The artwork, the photography, to complement the writing that goes alongside it, and probably the smell, I think, probably is worth £10 alone.
Oh, yeah. new magazine smell. It's fantastic. Forget buying a car. The smell of these magazines.
Absolutely.
When you get them out of the
Absolutely. Out of the That's just, it.
It's the first thing that hits you before you see absolutely anything.
It absolutely is. And the magazine that we're about to produce, that is about to be released in December, is AC Milan, the Rossonieri. Like I say, that will be released in the middle, beginning to middle of December, but it is actually available to order now. But aside from the selling pitch that is now complete, I would like to introduce our special guest, which is Mr. Matt Santangelo. Matt, how are you, sir?
Doing pretty well, guys. It's great to be on the podcast and, of course, to get involved with the magazine.
Excellent. Yeah, likewise. Well, obviously, the four of us have been lucky enough to be asked to contribute to one of the articles. So obviously, we have vested interest in it, as we do about all football aspects, to be fair. But Matt, how does it feel to be about the resident expert on tonight's podcast? Feeling good?
It's really an honor. Obviously, Milan's a club I hold near and dear to my heart. My favorite club that I support and since I was young. And yeah, it's like I'm ready to get dived in and kind of talk about the club that I love.
Excellent. Well, in that case, then, what we'll do to begin with then is if you can just, I suppose this could take an hour in itself. I am fully aware of that. But if you can, for you, AC Milan as an entity, you know, you talk about it being your favourite club. You know, what is it about AC Milan?
It's a rich history. It's tradition. It's passion. It's one of the premier clubs of not just Italy but European football as a whole. Although obviously they've fallen on darker times. I think you know when you look back to years past and you look at just the names that have put on this shirt, I think regardless of what state they're in currently, I think there's a lot of people who can fall back to those days and reminisce and kind of take something positive. Is that Milan were such a club of passion who were so feared around the continent. And, for me to see the way they've kind of fallen, I think there's, yes, obviously difficulties behind that, but I think at the same time, These Football Times does a great job of being able to kind of wind back the years a little bit and reminisce on those good times and hope that maybe Milan can kind of get back to where they once were.
Yeah, I mean, the magazines we've done, we've covered Boca, we've covered Dortmund, Ajax, Roma, Barca, and these clubs, like you say, and AC Milan is no different. There is such a rich vein of stories to be told, both, the sort of the narrative that is maybe quite familiar, but also, narrative that's probably not quite so familiar to some of the readers.
100%. I think there's, and this is something I've always think of myself, as someone who's kind of in that era where I've seen Milan obviously be the top team in Europe, the top dog. But there's also a lot of people nowadays, and especially in the social media era, where, they've only really have been able to read about it, not so much experience it as a fan. Maybe they were handed down, a Milan shirt when they were younger, and now all of a sudden they're kind of falling into this situation which they're currently in as a team that's, unfortunately kind of becoming like a laughing stock because it's just some of the players that are wearing the shirt that are not upholding to what it means and its value. So I think that's what also makes it very fascinating is to kind of go through the eras and see where, people are, what have they experienced? Have they experienced the great times? Have they experienced the bad times? And ultimately try to tie all those loose ends up and kind of get to where we are at right now.
Yeah, there's great comments that you make, the contemporary AC Milan, and I suppose, coming to you, Gary, first of all, Milan, the Milan that sort of, I suppose, certainly that Stephen and I grew up with and, that you will know, I know you often talk about some of the great players, from probably early to mid-80s and possibly even before, but Milan at one stage were the powerhouse of European football.
Oh, absolutely. They won the European Cup, dominated European football and also domestic Italian football. And obviously we were talking about the era with Sarri and then Capello afterwards. And then obviously it happened again with Carlo Ancelotti as manager. But as you said, some great names who played for have been failed to wear that Milan shirt, that Rossoneri shirt. you know, aside from the Dutch trio, Hullitz, Rijkaard and Van Basten, you know, you've got players like Maldini and Donadoni, Baresi. I mean, you know, I'm going to talk about Baresi in a bit because you won't shut me up about Baresi. You know, as you know, I think he's one of the best players of all time. But, you know, there's been some world-class stars. You know, I've just scattered around the edge there of players. You know, I could name 10 centre-backs who were world stars who played for... let alone, you know, the forwards who have graced the San Siro and in Rossoneri as well.
It's, I mean, Stephen, you know, we always seem to come up with the same points, you know, the same time, the same things. We think a lot about the same things. But, you know, for you and I, and I'm not speaking on your behalf, but I'm pretty sure, you know, when Italian football sort of hit the television screens on, you know, on Channel 4 and... you know, AC Milan were, you know, almost at the peak of their powers, and we were introduced to this whole other world on a weekly basis, on a Sunday afternoon, and you know, and AC Milan were sort of front and center of that moment in time.
Oh yeah, to be, you know, a club that would be so impressionable on a British audience, they couldn't have timed the dominance any better. And, you know, they came back to prominence towards the tail end of the 1980s after Sarri's arrival. You know, some of the building blocks were put in place by his lead home when he took. He went back to the club in 84. But, yeah, I mean, I can remember, like, football in the 80s and Italian football. What you used to have with Italian football, you didn't see much of it in the UK. You'd get the occasional goals shown on kind of like Tate and Greasy and Football Focus, but it would be powered by the fact that British or British-based players had gone to play over there. So, you know, Liam Brady going in 1980 initially to Juventus and then on to Inter and Sampdoria and Ascoli towards the end as well. You know, these players kind of like, they made Italian football seem such an evocative thing, basically. You know, the names and the kits and everything about it just seemed so amazing, really, so romantic. You know, I think one of the great interviews one time, I don't always agree with him, was one with Rodney Marsh, and he spoke of how British football was a great sport run by men in grey suits, and it was a cruel thing, and it wasn't necessarily completely true. It was an over-exaggeration, but compared to kind of like Italian football, yes, English British football was a much less colourful entity, basically. So yeah, these teams that just, you know, sprang to life throughout the 1980s, but it was something that just seemed to be out of reach until, you know, the regular footage started to tip up on British television. And I can remember being, you know, in the northwest of England, you know, with a portable television in the bedroom, and you used to be able to kind of like tune in to get the different kind of like variants of ITV and things like that. And we used to be able to pick up a very hazy picture of S4C, and there was a programme that's still in production now, but in a different guise called Scagorio. And they picked up Italian footage because Ian Rush had signed for Juventus. But by the time they went on air, he'd already returned to England. But they had the rights to show kind of like highlights and goals every Monday night. And it was just epic viewing. So even though it wasn't a particularly clear screen to be able to watch it through, you know, I watched the 88-89 title race and Inter winning it, the Inter of kind of like Mateus and Bremer. And AC Milan were like the defending champions. And because it was Hullitt and it was Van Basten and it was Rijkaard eventually. And this team just kind of like, they were just gold. You know, and don't forget, it was the era of Maradona at Napoli, and every team had a superstar in it, and Juventus were ailing somewhat, but they were just this storied club. But at the centre of it, there was AC Milan as the centrepiece of this era, and the stature was growing and growing and growing to won the title in 88 and then won back-to-back European Cups, and then moving into the 1990s. You know, before Channel 4 took over, you know, Sky showed it for a couple of years, and it was great. It was just brilliant to watch. And that unbeaten season in 91-92, I was just absolutely transfixed by, you know. So I'd watched that Sarri team kind of like unfold, and then eventually Capello take it on, and they just, they just seemed to get stronger and stronger with every passing season throughout the the end of the 80s and through into the mid 90s.
It's, I mean, you know, even just from there, guys, I was sort of, you know, a brief sort of preamble, if you like, as to what, you know, what AC Milan means and what it is to us. And, you know, Gary, I'm going to come to you in a couple of minutes about, you know, if you can kick us off about Baresi, and we'll sort of start, you know, we'll go back in time a little bit. But before I do that, Matt, as sort of the AC Milan expert, and you know, you know how the magazine works at these football times. And like we say, you know, it's 13, 14 articles. And we will come to, as we go through the podcast, you know, we'll come to your article and, you know, and who it's about. But I'm interested in how you decided what you wanted to talk about within the realms. When, you know, when someone opens up a club and says, okay, right, you know, write an article on the club, you know, and someone who follows a club so closely and so passionately like you do, how did you go about deciding the perspective of just one article that you were going to contribute?
Well, I think, you know, listen, I think there's, you know, this, that, the era for which I actually was really, really began to get immersed with Milan, of course, I was, you know, I'm born in the early 90s, so I kind of really caught the tail end of the 90s, which I know you guys talked about a little bit so far, and I'm sure the magazine is chock full of that stuff. So I wanted to kind of dive into, you know, kind of the most recent era of domination for Milan, right? The last glory era, if you will, of Milan. You mentioned Sacchi, you mentioned Capello, but then it was Ancelotti, right? And I think, you know, we look at, you know, the two the Champions League finals, right? We look at the 2005 against Liverpool, Istanbul, but then you also look at 2007 and even look at 2003 against Juventus, right? But you also have to keep in mind that, you know, there was that mix in between with the Deportivo collapse that Milan could have had 3 to 4 titles within, you know, a span. It could have been a true dynasty and one of the best dynasties ever. So when I was looking at this idea to contribute to this art, this magazine, I was like, you know, what was at the heart of that Milan era under Ancelotti of the you know, early 2000s, mid 2000s? And I think it was Pirlo and Gattuso. I think, you know, the stark differences between their styles of play. Obviously, you know, nowadays everyone glorifies, you know, the big passes and all that stuff because it's, again, so much more accessible. Social media plays a role in that as well. But I think, you know, it's easy to maybe forget a guy like Gattuso in this whole picture, right? Because I think he's not the stylistic player like a Pirlo. He wasn't the trailblazing player like Kaká against Manchester United. He wasn't one of the famed defenders like Ernesto Maldini. You know, he wasn't one of those players, but what he did for Milan, similar to what he did for the World Cup in 2006 for Italy, was he was that bulldog. He was willing to get his feet wet, his feet dirty, his hands dirty, and kind of, you know, be that midfield presence to kind of make things uncomfortable. I mean, obviously, Joe Jordan would be one of the guys that him, who would probably agree with that there, you know, choking and that and all that stuff and the outbursts on the field. But that was such a fascinating thing for me to want to talk about because, you know, we could even talk about Seedorf. And I think, you know, that's someone who, you know, doesn't really get the credit he fully deserves, in my opinion, at least. I don't know how you guys feel on that. But in terms of Pirlo and Gattuso, I think they were so different, but they were both, in their own way, so integral to what Milan were able to accomplish in that era. And really, if you look at it, I'm just speaking on the Italian national team part for a moment, that was off the back of Calciopoli. And, you know, for them to kind of go to the World Cup and be that defensive stalwart as a team, yes, but top to bottom, I mean, you had all the names that regardless of what was going on back home on domestic soil, they were still a real force. And then you look in that midfield as kind of the heart and soul, what they were able to accomplish in that era. So that's what kind of led me to Pirlo and Gattuso, me talking about the kind of beauty and the beast dynamic they shared.
That, I mean, it's great, and I can't wait, especially with Stephen being on as well, when we get to, because obviously we'll, you know, we have to touch on 05 and, like you say, in 07, and, you know, we'll touch on 03 as well. But yeah, I can't wait to get the perspective. Gary and I can just sit back for 5 minutes while you two chat about 05 and 07. Gary, you know, we'll start with you. We'll start with, you know, you've mentioned him already. You know, I know you know, you talk about, you know, it's somebody you idolise and eulogise a lot. And I know exactly how it feels. It almost brings out the child in you when you find players that you admire so much. And, you know, when you talk about him, you know, you can hear it in your voice. But, you know, for you, Baresi, was it always going to be Baresi for you?
Well, I actually didn't write about Baresi for the mag, but certainly Baresi is one of my all-time on favourite players. It's fascinating to hear Matt talk and the names tripping off the tongue and the passion of these players and how he sort of gets wrapped up in the emotion of it. You know, it's great to hear, and you know, I'm right there with you on that. For me, Barresi epitomised a defender. If there's a player that's going to be the icon of AC Milan, for me, it has to be Franco Barresi. I've written a couple of times about him because I just blooming idolised him as a player. And well, I came across an interview that Paolo Maldini did with Jamie Carragher. And he summed it up really nicely. He said, there's one thing about Franco Barresi, and that's exactly it. He was special. He was special. And people always sort of compare Barresi to Beckenbauer and say, OK, he didn't have that sort of elegant play of the ball. A lot of that is sort of perception rather than reality. There's a sort of a wonderful metaphor for the comparison between Barresi and Beckenbauer between Richard Wagner and Giuseppe Verdi, because Milan obviously has the famous La Scala opera house there, and they were sort of fairly contemporary at the time, and people used to say, well, this guy's better, Verdi's better, and Wagner's better, but the point is they were different. And you know, some people might say Beckenbauer's a better footballer, Barresi's by far distant a better defender. This guy who played all his career with the Rossoneri, and he had the opportunity to go and play somewhere else, never took it because he was a Milan, he was a Milanista, and he was never going to go and play for anybody else. And, you know, we want to sort of, you know, give a little bit of context to the player. This guy isn't a towering giant of a defender. This is not a Jaap Stam defender. This is not John Terry or that sort of player. This guy was 5'10". He wasn't even 6 foot. He played 6'3", but he was only 5'10" in height in reality. But he was blessed with an ability to read a game defensively, and when he sees the opportunity to carry the ball to defence, he was a gifted playmaker as well. And this is obviously where some people miss the comparison with Beckenbauer. But he was different in as much as, I say, he was far better defender, but he still could do that. That coming out of defence with the ball. Steve mentioned earlier about Niels Lidholm, and it was Lidholm who gave Barresi his debut. And he said about Barresi, at 18, he already had the knowledge of a veteran. And you're thinking, OK, you know, you can actually see that because he played all his career with that shirt hanging outside, sorry, shorts, but like nobody's going to hurry him up. He knew exactly what he's going to do. He's going to pinch the ball off you. You read a game magnificently. And another quote from Maldini, he said, it wasn't like Stam, a big guy who was strong and fast. He had pace, but he was only 70 kilos. But when he was a tackle, he hit you. He proper hit you. And, you know, there again, this is the determination and the will to win this guy's had. And in the 1994 World Cup in the USA, he had a bad injury and he was going to be sent home. But Barresi does not go home. He got himself recovered, and in the final against Brazil, he played outstandingly well. Now, this guy recovered, his knee injury, his cartilage injury, it might be an ACL, I can't remember. But it was almost the man of the match in the final. And it went to penalties, and he took a penalty because on Barresi, okay, he missed it. But he had the guts and nerve, and he was a leader. And not because he was shouting and bawling about there, but he led by example. And in the same interview, Maldini mentions that often in a game, you wouldn't hear Barresi. You'd see him, and he'd inspire you, but you wouldn't hear him shout. He wasn't a shouting and bawling sort of player. He was the guy who inspired people. Got the captaincy of the Rossoneri at 22. 22 years old. Can you imagine somebody getting the captaincy of AC Milan at 22? And he won 6 Serie A titles, 3 European Cups, 6 Coppa Italianas, 3 European Super Cups, and 2 International Cups. It ain't a bad haul, is it, really? I mean, you want to carry that about in your suitcase, you know. You need a forklift truck to carry your medals around. So, for me, you know, and I always bang on about, you know, Barry Hulsoff as well, who's, you know, bore people to death with. But if I could partner Barry Hulsoff and Franco Barresi in the middle of my defence, I'm done, guys. I'm done because Barresi is an outstanding talent. And, you know, as I say, I haven't got... I'm sitting here with a Milan shirt. I'm, you know, in special tribute for the club we're talking about tonight. And I haven't got six on my back. But I didn't do it because Milan has retired the six shirt after Bracey. So I thought, in honour of Bracey, I won't have the six on.
I was going to mention about the retirement of shirt numbers. I mean, obviously, we'll get onto Maldini as well in a little while, and obviously, you know, the retirement of shirt numbers. But a couple of guys as well around after the arrival of Baresi, if you like, but certainly coinciding with Baresi's time there. In a minute, Matt, I'll come to you a little bit just about Berlusconi, who for me is a figure that stands astride Milan and, you know, and the relatively recent history. But before we talk about him, Stephen Arrigo Sacchi and, you know, and his influence on AC Milan in that sort of at the very beginning, sort of mid to late 80s, and his influence, I suppose, on the reassertion of Milan's powers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about Sacchi as well, is he came out of nowhere. He was totally, totally left field. And he created this blinding legacy that Capello built upon. And there was a hypnotic kind of effect to it. You know, everything just seemed to fall into place. But like I said before, Leadholm had put some of the building blocks in place. And there was kind of like a collective that helped build that AC Milan to become what it was. But Sarki just absolutely revolutionised the club, because they had had a dark time of it in the 1980s. Totonero had taken them out of the top flight, and then they'd come back, they'd brought promotion back, but struggled on the pitch and went back down again. Came back up again in 83, and they struggled throughout those, like I said, those golden days earlier on. I mentioned when the English and British players, or British based players, were going to Serie A in their droves. And yes, there were, you know, players from that went to AC Milan, Joe Jordan, Luther Blissett, Ray Wilkins, Mark Hateley, and they had this little English version of themselves. But, you know, Sarki kind of stripped that away and went back to the artistry. And he kind of reawoke, you know, re-imaged AC Milan in his own image, basically, his own kind of template. But he also took something of the past, because he kind of made AC Milan back to the team that they were in the 50s and the 60s, and they were a great stylistic side in the 50s and the 60s. And he kind of took them back to the future in that respect. He made a futuristic version of something that had been in the past. And that AC Milan that Sarki built were just a wonderful side to watch.
Can I just jump in pretty briefly, Stu?
Of course, Gary, yeah.
I mean, Steve is absolutely right, and Berlusconi plucked Sarki from Parma, and his first season with Parma, he got Parma promoted, and the second term, he took Parma to, I think they were just 3 points short of winning the Scudetto when they got back to the to Serie A. And there's a wonderful quote that Sacchi, because he got slaughtered by the press. You know, it was ridiculous. Who is this guy? He's come from nowhere. He never played. He wasn't a great star player. And I couldn't exactly, but something along the lines of, you know, I didn't realise that you had to be a horse to learn to be a jockey.
You know, Gary's just mentioned there, Matt. You know, he's sort of brought the name of Berlusconi, and he's always been a character that has absolutely fascinated me. And you know, when I knew we were doing this podcast, and when, you know, we had the magazine coming out, I was looking at potential articles, and for me, Berlusconi just seems to be this, if you like, this godfather, literally this godfather figure that, you know, sort of from 86 onwards, he just sort of seems to stand astride and just be permanently associated with AC Milan. Even now, even with his career in politics, you know, he still seems to be the man that is associated with AC Milan.
100%. I think, you know, the biggest thing with Berlusconi is that, you know, before, you know, we obviously, we're talking about Milan, right, the sporting side of things, but this is a guy who pretty much traversed 3 to 4 fields, right, business, politics, sport, media, right, media set, Fininvest. The guy was doing everything, and it was almost like, you know, adding Milan. He's like, I'm going to purchase Milan, I'm going to save him from bankruptcy, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to pump a ton of money in, and I'm going to, it's pretty much, Milan's a trophy for him in itself, if you really look at it, right? You know, obviously, we know Milan has won so many trophies as a club. But when you look at Berlusconi's controversial career, is from whatever he was able to do, you look at and say on the Milan on the pedestal when he's looking in his home, you're like Milan, right? Because of the team that you know he saved and then put to the top of the mountain. And I think that what makes it so fascinating about Berlusconi, and he's still such a divisive figure, right? Because I think, you know, he's right now, they believe Corleone, he owns Monza, another small club. And I think Galliani's actually one of the directors there. So it's funny how they're both kind of traveling around to, you know, the Italian football, still kind of involved, just on a smaller scale. But, you know, when you speak on Berlusconi, you speak on, you know, all the kind of behind the scenes things. I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is that if you could find a way to separate all the things that were kind of you know, iffy, if you will, within in certain arenas and certain spectrums of you know, business and everything I mentioned previously, you can say that this guy was a true a king and kingpin and godfather, as you mentioned, for football, not just Italian football, for football in general. Because again, we got to remember, at that moment in time, if Berlusconi doesn't come in and rescue Milan from bankruptcy, we may not be talking about Milan at this point in time the way we talked about them. You probably wouldn't even be talking about a magazine here. So I think that's what's so, you know, to your point, and you know, when we get into the magazine and the nitty-gritty with the articles and so on and so forth, Berlusconi is really at the heart of Milan, regardless of, you know, what his current position is and what happened before him. He was kind of right smack dead of their success. And, you know, from years gone, and yeah, as we look to the future, he's still going to be talked about as this kind of, again, this really controversial figure, but one who needs to be discussed and needs to be held in high regard for what he was able to accomplish in football.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Steve, I'm just quickly going to come to you. And I was reading, again, you know, coming into this podcast, and I was reading about Berlusconi and his influence on what is now the Champions League. And, you know, there was an article whereby I think Milan were drawn against Napoli in the first round of the European Cup. And he identified there that there was a serious problem with the format of the European Cup, that such big sides could be eliminated. And I know you and I have discussions all the time about the European Cup and Champions League and what the best way around is. But he was, you know, he had the foresight and the vision in the sort of in the 80s to see what could and potentially should happen with regards to Champions League football, the future of the European Cup. And it's not just what he did with Milan. Like Matt said, his influence on European football as such, you know, is massive, isn't it?
Yeah, but a lot of the way that the European Cup Champions League has gone, Berlusconi, you know, played his part in revolutionising the tournament. So, you know, he was one of the great innovators in that respect. You know, he was forward-thinking. And that he was one of these people that, you know, remains one of those people that talking about as if his past. But, you know, he could marry kind of like football and the business side of his brain very, very well, like very few others can, because you would have owners, chairman of football clubs that, you know, were either kind of like businessmen that didn't quite get football, or, you know, failed businessmen that loved football. So it was one or the other. But with Berlusconi, he was one of those rare breeds that could master both, and you know, it was you know, absolutely majestic what he managed to do, along with the people that he appointed and the players that he helped accumulate and sign, and yeah, what he did with AC Milan was brilliant, but what he did across football still reverberates now.
It is, and I was sent a list just luckily, with regards to articles and, you know, what's in the magazine. And I think it's, you know, I think Chris Weir has done an article on Berlusconi and Galliani as well. So, you know, like we say, when you're trying to divide up such an important and iconic club into 14 pieces, it is really difficult. But clearly,
you couldn't leave him out there, because I mean, that's the great thing about him, is that, you know, the personality, the polarization of him, there's degrees of controversy. So there's kind of like so many multifaceted sides and elements to Berlusconi that, you know, you couldn't do an AC Milan magazine and not have a dedicated piece to it.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And it's I suppose the next, it seems to me that AC Milan seems to be a story of characters, be it players, be it managers, be it owners. And I know that sounds like every football club, but almost more than any other club, it seems to be dominated. And Gary's, mentioned Baresi as one of these players who's sat astride the club again for this prolonged period of time. And I suppose, Gary, the other one that we can't not mention that seemed to take the old Milan into the new Milan that maybe Matt's more familiar with, and that's Paolo Maldini.
Okay, so yeah, I just mentioned earlier about the comments Maldini made about Baresi and the partnership those guys had, but Maldini originally started as a right back rather than a centre back. And Costa Curta played alongside Baresi, and Sotti played as the other fullback. And in the first season with Sacchi at the helm, Milan conceded in the league 14 goals in the entire league season. 14 goals. The next best record was 27. Now, that sort of puts in perspective the sort of organisation that defence had. And obviously Maldini is like royal family to Milan. His father Cesare obviously played for Milan, and as I understand it, I think Maldini's son, Paolo Maldini's son, Daniel, has also signed to play for Milan as well. So there's a whole lineage of Maldinis in the club. And Matt mentioned earlier about his piece he wrote about Pirlo and Gattuso and Beauty and the Beast. I did a piece on Baresi and Maldini, and I just sort of, in my typical sort of, funny way, I'd allow it Beauty and the Best, because Maldini has that look, those film star looks that makes the girls swoon, but Baresi was, an outstanding defender. But, his sort of, his almost playboy exterior masks the professionalism of an outstanding player who played way into his 30s at the highest level of European football. Paolo Maldini is, as I say, the Maldini's are the royalty in Milan, and a little mate remains so because outstanding football, outstanding defender. Anybody who plays alongside, De Sotti, Costa Curta, and Baresi has got to be damn decent, and God, this guy was.
I mean, Matt, you talk about, I know we're all quite old on this podcast apart from yourself, but you talk about sort of the Milan of the new millennium, if you like, but Maldini, as much as Gary's talked about Baresi and we've mentioned Berlusconi and their influences, but Maldini's 25 years at a club. I mean, he really does span the old with the new in terms of the development of football as a game in Italy.
Absolutely, and I think the one thing that always fascinates me about Maldini is that for such a long career, for how good he was as a left back, and obviously how good he was as central defender. You go on Twitter and you look at some of the interactions that people have when people bring up who's the best defender, central defender of all time. People, they're like, Maldini was this. It's like he was so good at both. And I think that's what makes it so special and unique to talk about him, is the fact that there's some people who can't really explain what to categorize him as. And I think that's what makes it's so interesting and so fascinating. But that just goes to show you how impressive he was. And I know you guys alluded to Baresi and, the other defenders that were around him. That's what also kind of sheds more light on how strong Milan defensively were way back in the late 80s, early 90s with that. I just saw the Costa Curta, who were very class defenders, and they maybe don't get the credit that they deserve because of Baresi and Maldini kind of getting all the spotlight on them. And I think, when you speak on Maldini's footprint on Milan throughout his 25-year career as a player, but also what he's doing right now, behind the scenes as a more of a director role, I think it speaks volumes that Milan fans, they want to see a guy like Maldini involved and immersed in the club and all things that are going on. And I think that's going to continue to be the thing. And you guys touched on it as well, as the Maldini family being sort of this royalty family. And it's true with Cesare, and obviously he has two sons now. You have Daniel, and he's making headway into the Milan first team sooner rather than later. So I just think it's a long lineage of the Maldini name, and that namesake itself just holds so much value in the city of Milan and really in football. So I think, this is something that's, that name potentially is going to be something that could, span decades upon decades and really kind of, you know, traveled course of football's history.
Brilliant. I mean, you know, Stephen, you know, you've obviously, I think, you know, I think your piece is about the Maldini family connection, right, for the magazine.
Yeah, I've written about the Maldinis there, and you know, it's I don't think there's a family quite like them, you know, because for everything that Paolo Maldini did, which was absolutely stunning, both domestically and, you know, Europe, and playing for the national team, his father had done. Had done it in a, you know, Cesare was Milan's first, you know, European Cup winning captain, for instance. You know, and you know, I think people my age, people our age, will just remember the kind of like the craggy faced Italian national manager. You know, and but what he did as a player and a coach was phenomenal, and the two meet in the middle really, because Paolo's coaching career and, you know, his after football life has not matched Cesare's up to this point. So, you know, there's, while Paolo outstripped him as a player, you know, everything that Cesare, you know, achieved as a player was fantastic anyway. But then Paolo came along and he won more Serie A's than his dad. He won more European Cups than his dad. He played more times for the Azzurri than his dad. But then his dad's kind of like had this fantastic coaching career. You know, it goes largely unknown about, you know, how his Italy dominated the under-21 scene for a decade before he took on the senior coaching role with the Azzurri in 96 after Sarri stepped down. And as a family, they're just high achievers. And I don't think, certainly not many, I mean, while you do have football in families, it tends to be one big iconic player with a son that can't match up to the father. But the Maldinis, it's just kind of like one set of high achievement from, and then another with Paolo. And it'll be interesting to see how Paolo's son does in the years to come. His two sons, one's been through the Milan system and not quite made it, and he's having to stretch out elsewhere. But along comes the second one, and you can't, you know, not think that somewhere along the way we're going to see, you know, the third coming of the Maldinis in a Milan shirt.
And I think I'm right in saying, isn't it, although the number, you know, we're talking about Baresi and the retirement of the number six shirt, but the number three shirt can come out of retirement if Maldini's son is selected.
For a Maldini. That was the way they did it there. Yeah, they retired the shirt, but it can be reclaimed by one of his sons.
Brilliant.
if they can attain to those kind of levels that, you know, the previous generations of Maldini have.
Excellent. I mean, just staying with you for a minute, Stephen, and I want to sort of move on. And Matt, you know, Matt touched on this earlier, and that's the, you know, again, as we sort of progress through, you know, Berlusconi's been there, Baresi, Maldini, Sacchi's at the helm, and Capello's about to arrive. But also, you then have the three Dutch players arrive at the club: Hullet, Rijkaard, and one of my most favourite players of all time, Marco van Basten. And yeah. Again, it seemed to coincide with that, like I said earlier, that Channel 4 arrival, that increasing exposure of Italian football, and all of a sudden there were the three Dutch stars that we'd seen at the Euros, you know, in 88, and all of a sudden here they were all playing for the same club side, but not in Holland, in Italy. And it was, you know, and again, it was fascinating, and the impact that those three had, and we've talked about, you know, managers, players, and presidents so far, but again, the impact that those three had also can't be underestimated either.
No, it's absolutely phenomenal what they did. You know, there was a period in the 1970s where foreign players were banned from Italian football, and then there was a slow drip feeding of players coming back into the game from the late 70s, early 80s. It started with one, then it was two, then it expanded to three, and hence AC Milan ended up with Van Basten, Rijkaard, and Hullet, and what a selection of players to bring in to add to this fantastic domestic core of players that, you know, they were just so strong, and then to be able to add this flair and nonchalance, basically this Dutch kind of element to it that added a kind of a relaxation to a team that was absolutely made of granite, basically. you know, with Baresi and Maldini and just the power that swept through that side, and then to put this aesthetically pleasing trio into that side, the balance of what Sacchi, you know, created there was just perfection. And then for Capello to kind of like take that on and kind of like add more luster to it and more layers to it, you know, to bring it to that iconic 1994 Champions League final against, you know, Cruyff's Barcelona dream team. You know, these are my arguments when it comes down to the way Champions League is now and multiple teams from each nation being brought into, you know, games like AC Milan Barcelona when they were domestic champions and they hadn't qualified from second, third, or fourth place. They were their own domestic champions to get there. These games felt like Ali versus Frazier. It felt like Leonard versus Hagler. They felt like, you know, boxing matches almost. These were absolutely titanic games coming together. These head-to-heads that for teams that had fought the way there via domestic titles. And this is what the Champions League in its current guise has lost somewhat. You know, it's gained so much in what it's done. Don't get me wrong, but at the same time, it's lost that titanic feel to it. But that, for that Milan, you know, they were just jaw-dropping. And to be able to destruct and deconstruct that Barcelona side, which was a fabulous side, fabulous, fabulous side, to be able to do that to a team of that calibre, it was awe-inspiring and beautiful as it was shocking.
Oh, what a lovely soundbite that is. Gary, I'm going to come to you in a sec about Capello, but before I do, Matt, obviously, you know, Stephen's just waxed lyrical there about the three Dutchmen at AC Milan. Now, conversely as well, for a period of time at Inter, you had the three German internationals, Bremer, Klinsmann and Matthäus as well. And I'm not trying to ask you who you thought got the better deal, if you like, but it seemed that Milan, whether it was the other players that were around, whether it was a manager, but it seemed that the Rossoneri seemed to benefit more from the three Dutch than Inter did from the three German players.
Yeah, you know, obviously it's going to come off as very biased, being my allegiances to the red and black versus black and blue, but
oh no, yes, go ahead. It's fine.
I think when, you know, when you speak on, you know, I think, you know, it's difficult because in that era, that those eras of football and Italian football, you know, there were so many different names, so many players coming and going from all areas of the world, and I think, you know, for how all the success and history and the winning culture behind those three players at that time at Milan. You know, sometimes certain great players become an afterthought. Oh, I didn't realize this player played here, or I didn't, you know, realize this club achieved this with these three players that you just mentioned. So I think that's what also makes, you know, football in that era so majestic, so incredible to even kind of go back and reminisce on and romanticize about, because there was top to bottom in the league. There was just so many, there's so much talent, there's so many stories, so many characters, personalities to really unpack and kind of dive into. But, you know, when you talk about those three Dutch players, they completely changed the dynamic of Milan at that moment in time. You kind of threw on three perennial elites to what Milan's foundation already was doing. And that's what really kind of spearheaded just a more prolonged era of dominance for Milan on the continent. So I think Milan definitely got the better deal on that, but it's no disrespect to what Inter get, because obviously those three players are very special in their own way.
It is. And as well, Matt, I suppose this is just not off topic, but just at my own personal interest. And you know, you talk about that perception of players coming and going, you know, and Serie A was, you know, through the 90s, you know, was almost the height of fashion, if you like, in terms of for players, the league for players to play in. But in terms of Italian fans or, you know, Milan fans, and what was their perception of, you know, these players coming from different countries to play in their side? Were they welcomed? Were they embraced? Were they lauded? Or was it sceptical at times, or sceptical to begin with until the results started arriving?
Well, I'm sure there's always going to be some sort of skepticism behind, you know, different players coming in? How is it going to change the football that the people who have been around it so long have come to know, right? You know, obviously change is a very good thing, but sometimes it's very confusing and it's tough to get people on board with, right? But at that moment in time, in that era, if you will, I think it was very welcome in the sense that it was looking at saying, wow, like everyone wants to come to this league, to these stadiums, to these clubs, in the prime of their career, at certain parts of their career, to experience what it feels like to play in Italy. And then we all touch on, you know, Channel 4 and James Richardson and how that kind of added, that element added to it, right? So I think for me, you know, just someone who kind of, you know, grew up on the tail end of it and kind of really didn't start getting into it until like the early 2000s, I got the last remnants of it, if you will. I just think from everything I've been able to experience, those I've talked to, obviously including you guys, I think it was something that was very embraced, very welcome, and I think it left such a great footprint on football more than anything else, rather than just, you know, okay, Serie A was great at this moment in time. I think in general, when you look back on just the history of football dating back to the early 1900s, you can look at that era of the Italian 90 as saying, wow, this is when, at the peak of their powers, Italian football was royalty. It was where everyone wanted to be. It was pretty much right now what we're seeing in somewhat with the Premier League, right? And how we have what we have been seeing with the Premier League going on right now. So I just think, you know, that's, you know, I just wanted to quickly add that in there.
No, I think it's a great comment, like you say. I mean, I know we're here and we're talking about AC Milan and we're stretching out a little bit to, you know, Italian football, but you're right, the global impact of what was happening in the Italian League, Italian 90, and, you know, the arrival of the Germans at Inter, and, you know, and obviously the three Dutch players at Milan, and, you know, obviously had a massive impact on me, and I was just a young lad living in Hull, but I imagine that was replicated, you know, probably all around the world. Before we sort of come a little bit more up to date, and as you know, as Matt mentioned, the last great Milan dynasty, I suppose, you know, the last figure that maybe, you know, to look at is Capello, Gary, and, you know, and his impact after Sacchi, and the, you know, and the continuation of the work that had been done there is never easy, is it, to follow such an act?
Definitely not. And, you know, there's managers have a sort of shelf life, and perhaps Sacchi had reached the end of his useful time at Milan. Now, Berlusconi is one of these greats. I don't know if it's instinct or it's business nous, but he knew when it's time to move people on. And when the Azzurri came knocking for Sacchi, he was keen to let him go. And because he got a ready-made replacement there, and Capello had actually sat in the manager's chair a little before that, when Liedholm had gone, because Capello had been managing the Primavera Milan team and stepped into the manager's chair before Sacchi was appointed. But when Sacchi went, there was only one guy to turn to, and Capello was the guy. And he took over ahead of the 1991-92 season. And one of the key things he did was brought Albertini into the team. And Albertini had been signed by Sacchi a while ago, but he'd sent him out on loan. But Capello had realised that Ancelotti was reaching the end of his useful life as well, and he sort of shuffled Albertini into it. Albertini was an outstanding defensive midfield player, superb footballer, and he'd seen the success that Sacchi had achieved, and rather than someone just come in and say, well, we'll rip that up, we'll do it my way, he built on that rather than sort of turn it down. So he kept the defensive stability that Sacchi had built, but also switched the emphasis to the forward line. And in his first season, he won the Scudetto by 8 points. I think it's 8 points from Juve. And they actually went the entire league season undefeated. And that was extended to the following season. They won 58 games in Serie A before they lost. And it was a 1-0 defeat to Parma, I think it was in the March of 93. And Capello's team, they'd scored 74 goals in that when they won the league. 74 goals in a 34-game league programme in Serie A. The next best was Napoli's 56. You know, and Capello was no mug either. You know, once he got that success, he knew he'd got capital that he could use to spend Berlusconi's money. So he brought players in, Ranio, Papin, Savicevic, Boban, Desailly, Lentini, who was obviously had that massive problem with the car crash that destroyed his career. But, you know, Capello built on the success that Sacchi has built the foundations for. And, you know, Stevie alluded to earlier the European Cup final against Cruyff's Dream Team. And ahead of the final, Cruyff was taunting Capello, saying, you know, we spend our money on strikers and you bought Desailly. Well, Desailly was the man of the match in that final. Capello played him in midfield, ahead of the back four, and he snuffed out the entire Barcelona Dream Team forward line. Guardiola was playing as the pivot for Cruyff's team, hardly got a kick, and it was the somewhat appropriate that a French guy delivered the coup de grace in the final when Desailly broke through and killed the fourth goal past Zubizarreta to round out a 4-0 rout of a team that were touted to be the best team in Europe. You know, Capello was immensely successful with Milan.
I mean, Stephen, people think about Capello, you know, and Gary's made some great points, and he's sort of illustrated, if you like, where and how Capello made his name. Now, for some of the younger listeners or younger football fans, Capello is seen as the dictatorial overlord of the England team, if you like, who almost ruled by fear. In the England national team, when actually, you know, as Gary's mentioned there, his reputation was built on winning football teams.
Yeah, but they played good football as well. It wasn't just the solidity of the you know, there was an expansion to them. You know, Capello lost the services of Van Basten relatively swiftly, but, you know, he wasn't averse to kind of like bringing in other, you know, attacking players that could make a difference. You know, Papin was signed in 92. Lentini came in. That was a huge one. That summer of 92, where AC and Juventus traded world record transfer fees was phenomenal. You know, Milan bought Papin, Juventus bought Vialli, and then, you know, Milan trumped it all by spending 12 million on Lentini, which was absolutely massive at the time, and it broke the record for a third time that summer. And Italy was the centre of the undisputed centre of the universe at that time, and Capello just kind of like took what was already a perfect side and then took them beyond it. You know, they became platinum almost that 91-92 season, and I watched so many of the games that season. Because Sky was showing games live on a Sunday afternoon, so you could either watch kind of like a first division game on ITV or you, you know, stick Sky on. It was the first year that we had Sky at home, and I sat there and watched countless AC Milan games. I remember them dismantling Napoli 5-0. You know, they finished the season with an 8-2 victory over Zenon's hypnotic Foggia side that were just massive entertainment, no matter, you know, what they did, whether they were losing 8-2 or winning 4-2, you know, they were just fantastic to watch. And that 8-2 victory on the final day just kind of like encapsulated the whole insanity of that campaign. And like Gary said, it was March 93 before, you know, Capello suffered a league reversal in charge of AC Milan. He almost completed two back-to-back seasons unbeaten. And we're not talking about kind of like that football being now, we're talking about that football being played on what was still a relatively level playing field. You know, you've got to understand that Inter Milan were going out and spending massive money in chasing the title and trying to close the gap on AC. The Juventus were trying to, you know, desperately to regenerate themselves. They had Roberto Baggio. There were some phenomenal players at a massive amount of clubs. The Sampdoria that had won the title in 91, of Vialli and Lombardo, Mancini, you know, all the names that just trip off the tongue of every single club. And it was mentioned earlier about, you know, how powerful these teams were, but AC Milan rose above all of that to dominate in the most high-octane level of football that there's possibly been. It was almost like football crossed with Formula One. It was, you know, the great thing of that era of Serie A for me as well was how small the division was. It was an 18-team division. It was even a 16-team division when they won it in 87-88. and from kind of like 88, 89, and an 18-team division, four teams were going down. And you had to be, you know, a side of immense purpose just to stay in that division. And it just made it kind of like such a wonderful thing to watch, and such a to dominate and to play so well in that league with those players, the strength that was surrounding you, coming at you week in, week out. You know, you can't undersell just what that AC Milan side achieved in that environment.
I'll tell you what, we should be salesmen, the four of us. Surely with what we've spoken about so far, which is realistically only a small period of time within, you know, Milan's history and you know, and the stories and the, you know, the interest that they've generated as a club and as an entity. But, you know, we need to move on to that, to sort of the next chapter, if you like. Yep. And, you know, Matt, this now becomes, I suppose, the era that attracted you to this side. You know, you mentioned it right at the beginning. You know, you mentioned the players, Pirlo, Gattuso, Kaká, and, you know, and so on. And, you know, those three European Cup finals in 4 years under Ancelotti. And, you know, again, you know, people certainly, again, as we've listened and chatted about, our generation is very much of the Sarri and Capello era. But that era under Ancelotti, and, you know, like you said, it was the last great Milan era so far, but it shouldn't be underestimated how great that Milan era was under Ancelotti.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, we could talk, you know, all day about, you know, the Christmas tree formation. We could talk about the names and everything like that. You know, I think there's a lot of players that get lost, that get lost in the shuffle, and I think that's, you know, the unfortunate thing with, you know, having some of these really really big clubs and really big performances and these dynasties, if you will. Is that, you know, you look at certain players and you could talk about, you know, Nesta coming in, obviously, to play centrally with Maldini after, you know, a great, you know, early on part of his career by Lazio. Then you could talk about some of the midfield players, you know, Ambrosini, Seedorf, Gattuso, Pirlo, as I just mentioned, Kaká, Pipo, and Inzaghi. You know, there's so many articles that we probably could have included in this magazine. I'm sure many of you guys had many ideas for it. I'm sure you guys would agree with me on that, you know, but when I look at this era between, you know early 2000s, let's call it 2003, when Milan beat Juventus in the Champions League final, the famous Carlo Pellegatti commentary, the Shevchenko penalty goal, where he tugged in Dida, and obviously then 2004 Deportivo, where it could have been another one, could have been back to back, and if it wasn't for them pulling off such a great comeback and one of Europe Champions League's most historic comebacks, you can argue, Milan could have, again, in that span of time, you know, 3-4 titles. I mean, that would have even furthered what Carlo Ancelotti was able to accomplish in football. And obviously, he's already really well-respected around football. He's won everywhere he's went. But I think if you kind of look deeper into that era, that time at Milan as the manager, there was more left on the table. And I think that's what kind of, you know, there's a lot of Milan fans who, that's really the last bit of success, last bit of dominance that they've seen, witnessed, and felt as a Milan fan. And that's kind of the era where I kind of more or less came in and kind of, you know, fell in love with this club. So to see kind of the stark differences between, you know, being at the summit of football under Ancelotti, seeing Kaká win the Ballon d'Or, you know, what he was able to accomplish at Old Trafford, and then seeing what it is now, it's just, you know, it's a polar opposite. There's so many stark differences between these two eras. And in essence, you can look and you can really argue that, you know, after Ancelotti, everything's been completely downhill, and they haven't found a manager who can pull her down in an Ancelotti-like way, because, you know, aside from Martin Allegri, they've been going and running through managers every year. So I think that's really also makes it fascinating to kind of harp on the Ancelotti era as being the last sole era of dominance for Milan at the summit of football.
I mean, it's funny because I was chatting to Will, who's our sub-editor earlier today, and about the podcast and bits and pieces. And he's got a couple of questions, actually, that he's asked me to pass on to ask you, which I will do at the end, which is about the sort of current-day Milan side and the future of Milan as well, and, you know, which is where Will's sort of interest was lying when we were chatting today. But before we sort of get into these, I want to get into some of those Champions League finals, especially, obviously, with you, Stephen, as well. But sort of one of the players there, Gary, that that I don't think Matt did mention, and Andre Shevchenko, obviously as a Blues fan, I'm not saying you got the best version, but I'm not even sure you got the second or third best version at Chelsea. But a great player, a great goal scorer.
Oh, definitely. And you know when Shevchenko got to Chelsea, he was done really. But what that guy never did was never give less than 100% effort when he's playing the blue shirts. And so that's all you can ask. Now this is an exceptional guy. You see so many players coming from what are described to be minor leagues where they've been successful and then not making it to the big time. And when they at the end of the 1998-99 season, it won five successive league titles with in the Ukraine. And he's under the coach, the legendary Ukrainian coach, Valery Lebanovsky. And it was then that Berlusconi laid out $25 million to bring him to Milan. It had been 5 years since the Rossoneri had been champions of Europe. And the previous season, Oliver Bierhoff had been the club's leading goal scorer. He was 31. He was never going to get any better. And there was only one other player in that season for Milan who'd got double figures of goals, and that was Leonardo. So obviously something they do doing. And we're back to Berlusconi's genius, shall we say, or perceptive brilliance, or able to see the solution to a problem. He signed the guy, and in the open fixture of the season, he announced his arrival by scoring an equaliser after Milan were 2-0 down at home to Lecce. And things just went on and on from that. You know, he was Coppa Calcio twice. In his first season, he was top goal scorer. There's only been five other non-Italian players who've achieved that in the debut season. And those five are Platini, John Charles, Gunnar Nordahl, Ispan Nayas, and Ferenc Izbar. I think a bad company is in there. But it went on into massive success with Milan. And obviously, we talk about the European Cup finals. But Shevchenko was a regular goal scorer. And he's one of these guys where you look at and you think, is he particularly fast? No. Is he particularly tall? No. Is he particularly strong? No. Can he beat a man? Well, not particularly. He's not a great dribbler. How does this guy score goals? But he scored all kinds of goals. And there's a wonderful story about after the final when he scored the winning penalty. Afterwards, he flew to the Ukraine and he wanted to put his Champions League winner's medal by the side of Lebanovsky's grave, which I think in Kiev, which I think it's a wonderful tribute, you know, and recognises what the guy had done for him to create his talent and the success he would have afterwards. And it was in May 2006 that Berlusconi wrung every last penny out of Roman Abramovich before he let Shevchenko go. And, you know, whatever money Milan paid Shevchenko in wages over that period when he was playing in the famous red and black stripes, the deferment on the curve of Sud would say it was worth every single cent of it, because this guy was the ultimate predator goal scorer in European football.
I've got to say, Gary, listening to you, have you ever thought about being a player's agent?
They couldn't afford me, mate. They couldn't afford me.
I think you could make Hull City's back four sound world class with the passion and the way you speak about players. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Stephen, you know, obviously there's some highs and lows for you to come right now. And, you know, Matt mentioned right at the beginning, you know, three European Cup finals in 4 years, the Deportivo tie. You know, again, you know, we've looked at Madrid relatively recently with three European Cup finals in a row. I mean, Milan of those sort of mid-2000s were of that ilk, that dominant ilk. But then, obviously, in 2005, you have, for me, probably one of the greatest European Cup finals of all time. But just before I get sort of your thoughts and opinions on the Milan side, because unfortunately this isn't a Liverpool podcast, but it's
I'll restrain myself. I will restrain myself.
I'm sure your time will come in the next few weeks. I'm sure your time will come. But as a starting lineup of Dida, Cafu, Yapstam, Nesta, Maldini, Pirlo, Gattuso, Seedorf, Kaká, Shevchenko, and Crespo, again, when I was looking at this podcast, I'd not. I knew it was a good AC Milan side, but then when you actually look 1-11 and 3-0 up at half time, it should have been 3-0 at half time, and you could only ever see it going one way. How Liverpool overcame, not being disrespectful to you or the Liverpool listeners, of course, but how they overcame a side of that quality, that much in control, with that much talent to spare, almost, if you like, having scored certainly the Crespo goal and the Kaká through ball, is for me is one of the great goals of all time as well. I still don't know how Liverpool beat that Milan side.
Neither do I, Steve. Neither do I.
That's that chatting about them.
But that's, I mean, that comeback that my team managed to do in Istanbul. I mean, I was there. That's what will be on the tombstone. I was there. They did it. It's what it does is it takes away or it shades just how fantastic and majestic AC Milan were in the first half, the first 45 minutes of that game. It's a game that just kind of like blew that away because of the events of what happened in those mad 6 minutes in the second half and the wild occurrences in extra time when Shevchenko really should have got the ball over the line and somehow Dudek kept it out. But yeah, that Milan, it was a gravity defying outcome, basically. We went into that game with no kind of illusions that yes, we could do it because we'd done some pretty great stuff to get there in the first place. So there was this momentum going. So it was never impossible, but at 3-0 down at half time, it couldn't have seemed anything else other than impossible. And that Milan were just majestic. And as Matt said earlier on about how it was Milan's last period of great domination under Ancelotti, it was also the last great period of assurance, of kind of like stability. You know, you knew what you had. It was Ancelotti, and I absolutely love Carlo Ancelotti. I think he's fantastic. Can't praise him enough. And he put together this outstanding side, and yeah, they were again, you know, stability. They were Italian football once again, and that had been kind of like it had been stamped 2 years earlier at Old Trafford when they defeated Juventus in a game that, you know, depending on how you watch your football, it was either one of the worst finals ever or it was a fascinating final. And for me, it was somewhere in between. It was nowhere near the worst final ever, but, you know, it was fascinating the way that Milan and Juventus, you know, dealt with each other, and that was the thing, that they prevailed in 2003 against a very strong Juventus side, and they were just this formidable proposition to have to get past, and it was a ramshackle Liverpool side that Benitez had only inherited a year earlier. He was still trying to juggle it around, and we shouldn't have really been there, but we were. And despite we had Gerrard, yes, we had Alonso, some fine Carragher, some fine Hippie, fine players in there. You know, we were a work in progress, and we shouldn't have been able to do what we did. But that Milan side came back 2 years later and got one over on us, and we were a better side at that time as well. We were 2 years further down the Benitez project. It was a much more stable side. We were stronger. We were much more focused. We played better 2 years later than we did in 2005. Yeah, the brakes fell to Milan. It was a deflection, and yeah, they won the day in Athens, and deservedly so. I think even though we were a better side than we were 2 years earlier, Milan was still a better side in Athens, and that strength of character. But I feel that 2005 kind of broke them in some manner. Yes, they came back to win in 2007, but I think it was a massive psychological blow to the club that they've perhaps never got over. I'm a great believer in the fact that when teams fall from this empirical status, and I've seen Liverpool do it from the end of the 1980s, and I'm kind of interested observer in how Manchester United are doing exactly the same thing. I say that as a Liverpool fan enjoying it, but also fascinated as a football fan in how an empire falls apart, how it crumbles. And And I think the blow to AC Milan was 2005. Yes, they come back and win it 2 years later. Yes, there is still a Serie A title in 2011. But I think Istanbul is something that maybe even to this day still plays on the mind of the club. And it might take half a generation for them to get over that and to be able to rebuild and come back. But that era of Ancelotti was as good as any, you know, era of the club. It stands the test against the 50s side, the 60s, the side that did well in the 70s, and the Sarri and Capello sides that reached such a height. You know, it might not be that level, but at the same time, it did some pretty special stuff. And to get to three Champions League finals in such a short space of time, to win two of them, and as we said, should have got to more as well. They were one of the in a litany of great AC Milan sides. You know, they fall by the wayside unjustly, but as the last great AC Milan side, they should be way up there.
Can we just jump in for a second there, Stu? As always, Steve's absolutely nailed it. I agree 100% with what he said. You know, he might need to disagree a little bit, but, you know, aside from perhaps Gerrard and perhaps Alonso, I'm not sure any of the Liverpool players would have got into the AC Milan team. You know, if you're going to pick a team from both sides. But what Liverpool did to AC Milan was almost, they shocked them by their own mortality. You might be this imperious side that strides around like some kind of giant, but you're vulnerable. You're not only vulnerable, you can be beaten. And I think it gave them that sort of, you know, a fear of death almost. You know that they you know you're not the you might be the best team in the world, but you've got weaknesses. And, you know, you've just been exploited by them. And although, as Steve says, they came back and won the trophy afterwards, I think they were in decline from that time. And, it was a cathartic moment. Steve often uses the phrase moving of tectonic plates in football. I think that's a classic example of it.
Yeah, I would add to that as well, is that night in Istanbul, you know, so the story goes that Milan celebrated like they'd won it. At half time, you know, they could hear the celebrations from the Liverpool dressing room, and that kind of that when the comeback, you know, was on, and that first goal went in, it sparked a kind of perhaps if Milan had kind of kept the lid on the celebrations at half time, then maybe Liverpool. And I think that was one of the great things about Italian football as well, is that traditionally, you know, if a team is losing 3-0 at half time in a Serie A game, that, you know, it was game over. The team that is 3-0 down does not try to come back into it, but the team that is 3-0 up does not kind of like rub the team that is 3-0 down's nose in it. So there's almost an unspoken kind of agreement that the scoreline at half time will be the scoreline at full time. There's no further kind of, you know, torment for the losing side to go through. But, you know, it's a case of game done and dusted. And because a lot of the comments after the game from the Milan side was that, you know, that simply does not happen in Italian football. And it did in that Champions League final.
Yeah, absolutely agree, Steve.
It's, I mean, you know, guys, as we say, you know, we're already well over our sort of normal time frame, which is fine, because unfortunately I control the technology here, so that's fine. So we're good to go. But I suppose just one last thing, Matt, which, like I say, you know, I mentioned about Will, and I suppose, you know, we need to sort of bring this Milan story up to date. But guys, as well, I'm gonna ask you for your opinion for the greatest ever Milan player. So you need to start thinking about that one, because that's how I'm gonna finish. But Matt, like I said, I was chatting with Will earlier, and he sort of asked, I suppose, me to ask your opinion on, what's it going to take for the current Milan side, the current Milan regime, the current Milan situation, to recover and to regain some of these past glories? Now, I'm not saying they will dominate Italian football like they did in the sort of late 80s through mid 90s, or even across the early 2000s. But, you know, what is it that Milan, they seem so far away at the moment? And Stephen used the example of Manchester United, which I suppose is, although they're less into their decline, if you like. But what is it going to take for Milan to actually recover some of this past glory?
Honestly, I think that it's time, and I think time is it's a really very vague response. But I think the truth of the matter is that times have changed. The financial landscape of football has changed. It's no longer there's a lot of more competitive clubs, a lot of clubs that are coming in now that they weren't previously around and really posed a big threat to win the Champions League, win major honors, so on and so forth. But with Milan, it's a really difficult situation. And I think, I get this question a lot is, well, what does Milan need to essentially not get back to being, Milan? Because I don't think they're ever going to be back to being, that dominant, at least in this current, era. But being kind of relevant in the sense that, hey, like, we're a factor in Serie A. We're back in the Champions League. We're making some pretty good runs. We have the names of the past or somewhat comparable to the past, where you can lean on and you can say, okay, this is more of a Milan I came to know. And I think there's a culmination of things that need to really happen. And I think over time, ultimately, that's what you hope comes into place. I mean, you can talk about, they're not spending on the right players. And I think that's obviously you can make a great case for that. But at the same time, it's that we've seen many clubs in different various leagues try to outspend their way and try to spend their way out of problems. And it's just simply not the case. You guys alluded to Manchester United being one of them. They're a club that is in somewhat similar of a situation to Milan. But in this, there's a difference between that and them and Milan in the sense that they can actually spend on certain players. They still have that draw to the Premier League, which is still very hot. And it's definitely obviously still a major, major player in the grand scheme of things of world football. So, you can look towards the manager, right? If we talked about Ancelotti, but we talked about all the managers that have followed Ancelotti, and listen, they're not going to be Ancelotti. It's just that simple. And everyone who was demanding a Conte type or a Maurizio Sarri type, it's just the truth of the matter is that these managers, they want to coach at the top level. They want to coach in the Champions League. They want to win honors. And this Milan situation is probably the most difficult one amongst the European clubs currently battling some managerial situations, if you guys would agree with me on that. Because, there's the financial fair play issues. There's a constant, changing at the guard up top with management and ownership year to year. It seems like, no one really has a grasp on what Elliott is as a hedge fund, whether they want to keep this club going on or they want to simply flip it and pawn it off to someone else to take care of it. Who really knows? I think that's the toughest thing to kind of just decipher with this Milan is that, you can't really see and put a time frame on when they're going to be back to relevance. And I think that's the hardest part for me as a Milan fan and for many others who love Milan and have experienced the glory years and the finer things of these colors to kind of stomach at this point in time. Because, the last major trophy they won was with Berlusconi, Galliani. They brought in Ibrahimovic, Robinho. They still had Cassano. They still had a lot of older members of the old guard of those Champions League teams that we just previously discussed. But after those players left in 2011, 2012, that's where things kind of evaporated and it kind of just took a complete nosedive, and they haven't been able to recover since. So I think in short, I know I went on here quite a bit, but I think time is really what's going to be the ultimate decider here. Because listen, last year they were the closest they've ever been to getting back into the Champions League. They were 1 point off with Gennaro Gattuso, who took over in a very difficult situation, and now they're completely falling back further with the current situation they're in this season as a 12th, 13th, 14th place club, really essentially 5 or 6 points back of relegation. So it's really tough to kind of put a time frame on when they're going to be back.
Don't worry about how much time it takes, Matt. I'm sure, like you say, the solving of AC Milan's problem is not going to be done in a 2 or 3 minute monologue on a podcast. Don't worry about that. Like I say, it could almost be a podcast in itself. Looking at how Milan can reassert itself not only in domestic Italian football but in European football as well. Look, guys, we need to sort of, like I say, we need to sort of draw it to a close. And I'm, hopefully, everyone who's listened is, you know, has enjoyed it certainly as much as I have listening to you three guys. Hopefully, you know, there's so much more in the magazine apart from the, you know, sort of the eras that we've talked about and the players that we've talked about. That, you know, there's so much more in there. But before we finish, just, you know, your opinions, no pressure. Obviously, try not to pick the same ones. Who are the in your opinion, the greatest player to ever play for AC Milan? Gary, I'll start with you first.
Oh, thank you, Mike, because if anybody else had chose Baresi, I would
That's why I picked you first.
Yeah, bless you, Mike. Bless you, mate. You know, while you were talking, I was thinking, OK, I could list some players, but what I did was I listed defenders. So we've got Trapattoni, Rosato, Anquiletti, Colavati, Panucci, Desailly, Stam, Calazza, Thiago Silva, Cafu, Nesta, the two Maldinis, Costa Curta, Tassotti. But above them all stands Baresi. Now, I wrote about Sheva for the magazine, you know, for lots of reasons, but to me, the only guy who stands head and shoulders as the iconic player for AC Milan is Baresi. And I'm just going to sort of, you know, give a little bit of a cultural sort of justification for that. I mentioned Verdi earlier, who his first opera at the Scala, which is fantastic opera house, if anybody's been there, was called Alberto, the Conte di San Bonifacio. And it's a story of loyalty and honour. And the hero of the opera dies in a duel rather than compromise his fidelity. Now, Baresi didn't quite go that far, but he certainly devoted his entire career to the Rossoneri. And he often turned down opportunities to move to another club. And he stayed with Milan when they endured dark periods. And so not only for his achievements, the trophies and the glory, it's the loyalty in times of adversity that finally attach a player into a fan's affection. And it's a place that Baresi clearly occupies for the Milan tifosi. He is the iconic Milan player.
Whoa, brilliant. Stephen, I wouldn't like to be you right now. So, in your opinion, who's the second best player? No, I'm kidding. Who's the best player for you to ever play for Milan?
I mean, they've had some outrageously talented players, even going back to kind of like, you know, like Altafini and Nordahl, and you know, so many of them that just, you know, encapsulated an era, basically. Rivera, another one. You know, Baresi speaks for himself. He doesn't need Gary to speak for him as eloquently as he's spoken to for him. You know, Baresi is just Baresi. But yeah, for me, you know, alongside him, there's only one other, you know, candidate really, and that's Maldini. You know, over 900 appearances, you know, a lifetime spent at the club in one form or another. You know, won absolutely everything there was to win at club level. Just a shame he couldn't have added a European Championship or a World Cup winners' medal at national level. But, you know, mastered not just one position, but, you know, at least two. Looked so comfortable elsewhere as well. You know, one of the world's greatest left-backs, yet one of the world's greatest centre-backs. And for a player to be able to master more than one position. I mean, you can be, you know, we all know that concept of being a jack of all trades and a master of, if not none, a few of them. You know, it wasn't a case of him being, you know, the world's best left back and a capable centre back. He was an outstanding centre back as well, and just so stylish and elegant on the ball, and it made it look so effortless, and never seemed to kind of like break sweat. You know, and to be able to perform at such a high level at such a young age and so late on in football in terms as well, you know, he was just unimpeachable.
Oof, very, very good. Good comeback. Matt, it seems only fitting, really, that you should have the last word. You may well have picked Maldini or Baresi, in which case I apologise. But for you, who is the greatest Milan player of all time?
So obviously, yeah, my first pick would have been Maldini, but I think it would have been Baresi. I think both of them would have been the easier choices, and I think they're very much deserving of this honor. I'm going to go with a different one, and I think, you know, it maybe wasn't nearly as much of a long stretch of dominance and really being at his peak, but I think Kaká was a player that was
brilliant,
so influential during those years, and the fact that he was able to essentially come in and really play Rui Costa, who I think to this day is still Milan's most expensive transfer ever, and he was so great at Fiorentina with Batistuta, to come into that squad, effectively kick him out, overtake that role, and become Milan's, you know, their big key attacking player, who obviously won the Ballon d'Or over Messi and Ronaldo, was influential in that Champions League in 2007, obviously. He was a player that, again, you know, there's a lot of mixed opinions on him. If you go on just, you know, Twitter and Facebook, and people saying he didn't really do it for as long as some of the other players have, but at the peak of his powers, and you can obviously look to that at Old Trafford as one of them to kind of support this, he was unplayable. He was an unplayable player in the sense that he can do literally everything. He had the breakaway speed. He had the finishing, the eye for the goal. He had the ability to make you look silly, and even the best defenders at that time look silly. And I think that's what, for me, at the era of which I came up to grow and love Milan, Kaká was really at the heart of that. So I think, you know, with Baresi and Maldini, I'm going to go with Kaká just for the attachment that I have as a Milan fan growing up in that time.
That's a wonderful choice. And after David Beckham, he would have been my pick as well. No, I'm kidding. But I think Kaká is a wonderful, wonderful footballer. But I'm all about the flair players. I know Gary's all about the grisly centre-halves, and that's great. But yeah, for me, it's all about the number 10s and the flair players. I suppose, you know, guys, hopefully, you know, like I said, I've had a great time. Absolute great time listening to you. Hopefully the people who've listened, you know, are very tempted by, you know, by the magazine that you know, that we're now offering. Like I say, there's previous clubs out there already that we've covered. There's stories in the Milan edition coming out that, you know, we haven't even covered on the podcast. There's players that have been mentioned in passing that have entire articles devoted to them. You know, like I say, you know, we've all contributed to the magazine. You know, we've invested our time in the magazine, and we know what a great product it is. But, you know, I suppose, you know, it doesn't do it justice until, like I say, until you buy it and until you smell it. You're never going to know what a great product it is. And the other thing we should mention as well is they do sell out really quickly. It's a limited print run that we do, and they do sell out incredibly quickly. You know, you still get people wanting the Ajax ones, you know, that sold out straight away. I think the Barcelona one is close to being sold out. So, you know, they do go quickly. But, guys, you know, thank you so much. Stephen, as always, an absolute pleasure.
Oh, joy as always. You know, how can you spend a better hour and a quarter or so, you know, than chatting about, you know, the greatest moments of one of the greatest teams.
I know. These are just the best way to spend a Sunday night. It really is.
Oh, it is. It is.
Gary, again, thank you, sir, for your eulogising of a Franco Baresi. I've missed it.
I had an absolute ball, mate. And as Stevie says, you know, I'm not sure there's any better way to spend a Sunday evening than talking about, you know, some of the great, one of the greatest clubs in European football history. And, you know, I mean, of course I'm a little biased because I write for the magazine, but, you know, it's great to either think of beauty, so go out and buy the mag because it's a bloody brilliant.
It is. Like I said, you should be an agent. You really should. Matt, thank you. Also, guest of honour and on-air expert tonight that sort of guided us through the trials and tribulations of Milan, and also put together a slight blueprint for getting them back to perhaps where they belong at the top table of European football.
It's been a real joy, guys. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, I know it's difficult times for Milan for sure, but still a club I hold near and dear to my heart, and I'm glad you guys gave me the opportunity to speak on them.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. All that's left is for me to say thank you very much for listening. Please buy the magazine. It is actually really good. It's far better than us four chatting. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.